from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Sonia Sotomayor was nominated by President Barack Obama to the United States Supreme Court as an associate justice, a role she assumed in August of 2009. A native of the South Bronx Housing Projects who went on to graduate summa cum laude from Princeton and Yale Law School, she served as an assistant district attorney in New York and then as a judge of the U.S. District Court in New York and on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. She recently published a memoir of her life, which takes us up to the realization of her girlhood dream of becoming a judge, inspired no less by Perry Mason. And her book is titled My Beloved World. She joins us in studio for this morning's Second Forum Hour. So pleased to have you with us. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael.
Your story, I mean, it's almost a cliche to say, but nonetheless true, is really an inspiring story because it's a kind of Horatio Alger story. You know, you apply to college and they ask what assets? None. But going from that kind of poverty and going from adversity to become seated on the Supreme Court is almost like saying, in some sense, it doesn't matter who you are or where you were born, you can be anybody you want to be.
That's the message in my book. And I wrote it so that every kid who's just like me, and there's a whole lot of them out there, could see themselves in me and could see the potential for them to reach anything they want to be.
You not only had the adversity, though, of growing up poor, your father dying when you were a child and his being an alcoholic, but having diabetes, juvenile diabetes, and having a shoot yourself full of insulin.
You know, diabetes is just an inherent part of me. It's ever present. I am constantly, the day long, checking in with my own body to find out where my sugar levels are. Every time I eat, I have to calculate how much insulin to take. If I'm sick, I have to figure out how high my sugars will raise and what I need to do to combat it. It's ever present.
Well, it started when you were 8 years old, right?
Started when I was 7 and a half, to be exact. But it did, and it's never left and won't leave because I'm a juvenile type 1 diabetes. But part of the message of this book to kids with chronic diseases, and there's a lot of them with diseases besides juvenile diabetes, is that even disease doesn't need to stop you, but that you have to pay attention to it. I mean, one of the reasons that I'm as healthy as I am is because I do pay attention. But paying attention doesn't mean that it takes away from your enjoyment of life. It means that it becomes a part of your life. And I talk about the greatest gift diabetes gave me, which is an incredible sense of discipline. When you, at the age of 7 and a half, have to get up in the mornings and at that time boil water to purify your syringes. There weren't disposable syringes back then. And take your shot and watch what you eat all day. And just to be careful with what you do, it's a discipline that helps you in every other aspect of your life. And a discipline to eat in moderation. You know, I eat anything I want. I just don't eat a lot of it if it's bad for me.
Well, you come across as not only a disciplined child. Discipline was a big thing, even with a metal ruler at Blessed Sacrament when you went to school. Your father's gift of a metal ruler, which stays in my head, of course.
Oh, can you imagine my eyes?
You get bullied as a result of that, didn't you?
Well, I don't know if I was bullied, but my poor brother was. And, you know, being a kid in the South Bronx, which was even then a tough neighborhood, or even more so then a tough neighborhood, he got bullied, and I interceded a lot to help him out. But you have to be tough in the kind of neighborhood I grew up in. If you want to survive, but B, if you want to thrive, you have to build your own sense of independence in that environment. And you have to be willing not to let people push you around.
Well, your brother, too, succeeded. I mean, in the sense that he's got a medical degree. But there's a very sad story in here about a cousin named Nelson who did not succeed. I mean, in the sense of got involved in some bad stuff as a result of the neighborhood, too. I mean, it could go either way.
It does. And I talk in the book about why our paths were so different, despite being inseparable as children and coming from a nearly identical environment. I mean, his parents were different than mine, but yet he couldn't survive it. And I did. And some of that was the discipline I learned from diabetes. And some of that was what he described to me near the end of his life. He said, Sonia, you have a perseverance that I don't have. You don't let anything stop you. And I think he was right. I tell kids all the time, well, I tell them something President Calvin Coolidge said. There's a lot of talented people out there, a lot of people with high IQs and big genius, a lot of well-educated people. But the people who succeed are the ones with perseverance. And in some ways, that's what I found.
Maybe it's the way you're wired, some would argue. I know you want to inspire children, but maybe you're wired differently. You have the obstinacy, and you even describe yourself as a rational child. In fact, I wanted to ask you about that, as well as maybe the whole question of how much what's built into you. I mean, you had the love of a grandmother, Abuelita, which was major force in your life, but so did he. So you have to ask how much of it had to do maybe with being a diabetic and those kinds of factors, the adversities that you suffered.
Some obviously has to be within me, but I think every child, if exposed to what it takes to make it, can borrow a little bit from it. I tell shy children all the time, it's really hard to overcome sometimes, but you can use that shyness to your advantage if you can figure out the moments when you have to step out of it. And that's really the key to success, which is you don't have to alter your style altogether. You just have to figure out when you need to step aside from it to get something done. And that's a little bit of what I try to show in my book. I discuss a lot of failures in my life.
I think you show it well, and I think you do go into a lot of the failures in an in-depth way. It's a kind of daring writing for somebody who sits on the court. You know, you usually don't associate these kind of books that talk so much about the inner life and personal life and development. I mean, I've had Justice Breyer on. You know, I know that other justices have written stories about their lives, but this is a very personal and personalized story. It's your story.
It is my story. And it's my story in a personal and candid and honest way, because I really want everyone who reads it to say, she's just like me. And if she could do it, so can I.
Well, I can see people reading this and saying, boy, she's just like me maybe on some levels, but she's a lot smarter than I am, or she's a lot more dogged than I am, or a lot tougher and more talented than I am.
Well, if they say that, I hope they'll go out and try to be tougher than me.
One up you, huh? I'll talk to you about actually some of the early formative experiences that you had. And you, by the way, you write quite well here. I just wanted to, my English professor had on, you know, you write really not only thoughtfully, but in many instances lyrically and powerfully. And I know writing was a real struggle for you at one point, particularly because you came from a Spanish-speaking household. But this is a different kind of writing than legal writing.
Absolutely, and it was such a joy to find it within me. You know, I've been a judge for nearly 20 years, and all of my writing has been pretty technical, dry legal writing, in part because I am what many call a lawyer's judge. I try to explain what I'm doing in a way that's understandable to lawyers and lower court judges, and do it in a logical and persuasive way. But I don't think of doing legal writing with a flair. Undertaking this project was a new learning experience for me. It was a new challenge. I've done a lot of public speaking, and I knew from my public speaking that I'm often more eloquent speaking than I am in writing. And to finally sit down and learn, because I worked with people who are writers to help guide me and read my work and tell me how I could improve it and what I should be thinking about doing, it was a totally new process, and it was wonderful to find that side of Sonia.
That's like, I remember Paul Auster telling me writing a memoir is like going through a desk and finding things that you forgot were there or maybe didn't realize were there. It lights up your own consciousness in ways that you didn't expect.
You know what I did? I first started by talking into a tape recorder and just telling every story I could remember, and I thought that would be a two-week process. Well, it turned out to be a six-month process of talking into a tape recorder. But even after that, after I had produced my first manuscript, some of my readers of my manuscript would ask questions, and it would stimulate a different memory, one that I had totally forgotten I had. It was an amazing, amazing process to see how deep I could go in remembering. I won't even try to tell you all the stories that ended up on the cutting room floor.
The book is My Beloved World, and our guest is Justice Sonia Sotomayor, and she is, of course, a justice on the United States Supreme Court. And I wasn't kidding about the inspiration of Perry Mason. It really did affect you that way, huh?
Absolutely.
God, just think if they had Judge Judy in your day.
Right? Oh, my. Well, I'm not quite sure that I would have thought the same thing about the practice of law or being a judge. No, I understand she's done a lot for people to think about the law and to think about what it can accomplish that's different than what
TV.
Happens.
It's a little coarseness of the law.
Oh, know. Absolutely. And so is Perry Mason. I don't know a defense attorney who's ever broken down a witness on the witness stand who confesses to having committed a crime. I tell that to people who I speak to about the inspiration of Perry Mason. Been a judge for 20 years, didn't happen in my courtroom, and it hasn't happened in any transcript I've read.
So, you know, as a young girl growing up in a Puerto Rican household, and you also tell your mother's story and you go back to Puerto Rico and it's very moving kind of seminal experience with your grandfather and your mother saying who she is, and there'd been all this estrangement. I mean, there's a narrative here that really gets at some very deep and profound human kinds of stories. But you take us into that world that Rita Moreno lives out here, and she happens to be a friend, and she talks about how the whole sense of growing up a Puerto Rican really was growing up with knowing that people were viewing you a certain way, that they were judging you. So, of course, you were often mistaken for Jewish.
But, yes.
But it does
a little less since I've gotten my hair curly.
It's also the accent, maybe, perhaps. But there was a sense that she has communicated to me that, you know, I'm different because I'm Puerto Rican, and the bigotry that followed on that.
What you said about being ever cognizant of the fact that people look at you a certain way, it doesn't go away because people show it in so many different ways. I mean, I talk about many of those incidents in my book, but I don't tell a story here because I didn't take it to my judge years. I remember my first year, how many lawyers came into my courtroom and looked at me with this almost look of disdain. I couldn't always tell whether it was because I was a woman, young, or Puerto Rican, maybe a combination of the three. But it was always very, very satisfying to see the lawyer who walked in and looked at the wall to the side of him when he was talking to me. And as I kept asking him questions, at some point he became erect and turned around and actually looked at me. And I could see in his eyes that just that moment he figured out, I better be careful, she's smart. it was a moment that my law clerks noticed and came to me and said, Judge, we've seen it before, doesn't it bother you? And I looked at them and I said, no, it gives me a great deal of pride.
What a triumphant feeling.
Yeah. You know?
Well, you're mining a lot of memories here, and there's one moment that I'm going to take you back to. It's when, after your father dies, and there's this whole kind of bruja thing going on. You know, I mean, there you are muttering a word that to this day is mysterious to you. You didn't know where it came from, conformete, you know, it's okay. But you were this rational child. You describe yourself as a rational child. And I couldn't help reading that as linking it later on when your mother kind of holed herself off and didn't want to have anything to do with life, and you said, come on out, you know. You were assertive and rational, and so that came out of something of your unconscious that said, accept it, my father is dead.
You know, I have no idea where that came from. I was 9.5 years old when he died, and I don't even remember the memory. It's a memory that was relayed to me and has been confirmed repeatedly by my family. In fact, in writing this book, I sat down with all of them in a room, and we told stories, and my aunts, which were the only people who remembered it, repeated the story yet again. I do describe in the book being very sensitive as a child because of my dad's alcoholism. I was a very observant child.
And it was an alcoholism, we should mention, where his face would actually become distorted.
He would become Frankenstein. It's the only way I could describe it. And so whenever I was with him in a group setting, I was always watchful about when that change would start, because it meant the end of the party. And it also meant that the fighting would continue, would start again and continue at home. Mm-hmm. But that led me to be very sensitive to people. And I think I had never known such grief in my grandmother, in my abuelita, or in my mother than I did at my father's death. And I must have been looking for something to comfort them. And obviously, as a child, you don't know what to say. But somehow I found the right thing to say, which is conformite, which means accepted.
You had an aunt who wanted to jump in, who didn't see much of your father. But, I mean, it was quite an impact on the family, considering the fact that, as someone put it, his best friend in those days was Seagram 7.
Oh, it most certainly was. I will never forget Seagram 7 or Camel cigarettes, by the way. They were always in his pocket. You know, after I heard about what my father was, I understood later everybody's grief because they carried the memory my mother did of a vibrant, very intelligent and creative man.
And tender and loving, too.
And yeah. Tender and loving. And yeah. It was aspects of him that got lost in his later alcoholism that I didn't get to see. But I think the memory of that, in part, my child, Lucy Five Cents psychology, probably is true. There was a sense in everyone of a great loss of someone who was very special.
There's also a moment, not necessarily to dwell on your childhood, but it certainly floods me as a reader in all kinds of ways, when you're with your mother and she's by the side of her father and she says, "Yo soy Selena," and there had been this real rupture, distance. He really didn't exist for her. And
he didn't. He walked out when her mother died, which was at age 9. 9 seems to be a very telling number in our family. And she hadn't seen him. And so it had been, I think, at that time, close to 30, if not about 30 years, maybe close to 40. And for her to have to say to him, "Yo soy Selena," I am Selena, it was an extraordinary moment in my life. To watch two people who I thought should be close, who barely acknowledged each other. And I understood that that kind of hurt was very, very deep within my mother, something she couldn't forgive. But I also understood that that was a state I never wanted to reach with a person I loved. She had to have loved him at some point.
What drove you? I mean, other than all this adversity we've been talking about, there must have been something else in you that, I mean, because you were early on academically succeeding and, you know, went on to really a pretty stellar life in terms of success on all fronts as a judge, as a member of a law firm. I mean, what do you attribute that to other than what we're talking about?
Well, we talked about my stubbornness of never giving up, but I'm really competitive within myself. This is hard to explain to people. I've never played individual sports or team sports where I'm competitive against someone else and trying to best another person. I try to best me. I set goals.
You put the bar up.
I put the bar up. I went to college, and my first semester, I got 3 Bs and an A. And I'm not even sure I can remember why I got the A. It had to be because I didn't take a course where I had to do writing. But at any rate, the next semester, I wanted 2 A's and 2 B's. And I did that. And then I kept increasing it every year so that by my junior year, I was getting all A's. But that's how I've done it.
So where do you go now that you're on the Supreme Court? Your lifetime appointment. Where do you go from
there's
here?
There's so much to do still. I want to become a great justice. Justice Stevens said to me during my first year in one of our exchanges, "Sonia, no one is born a justice. You grow into it." And I've only been on the court 3.5 years. It'll take me a long time to reach the goal of being a great justice, but I'm working at it.
Well, you also quit smoking. I mean, I can only get President Obama to do that, I think.
I think he has. I thought I heard he has. Well, I can tell you something. I've been near him a lot, And I haven't smelt any smoke on his clothing.
All right, we've got the olfactory proof here for you listeners who are worried about the president and his tobacco habit. We're talking to Sonia Sotomayor, and her new book is My Beloved World. It is really telling her story and also telling her mother's story and the story of her family. And it is nothing less than I use the word advisedly and sparingly, but an inspiring story, particularly in the sense of if Barack Obama could grow up to become the president of the United States, then, a young Hispanic girl can grow up to become a member of the United States Supreme Court, or even the president of the United States, for that matter. But there's also the sense that, young girls shouldn't be disillusioned into thinking, I can follow a course and become a Supreme Court justice. I mean, Supreme Court justices are not named every day, or for that matter, they're not named sometimes for years at a time.
Well, there's nine of us. We have lifetime jobs. In one person's life, it's unlikely that more than nine justices will be named, and that's even unusual in some spreads of time. And people dream for things that are sometimes nearly impossible. I'm sure that Bill Clinton wasn't the only child who dreamt of being president. He just happened to be one of the very few that got there. But you know something? I tell kids all the time, it really doesn't matter what you aim for and whether you reach it or not. I say it in my book. What matters is the process, because each step forward you take enriches you in some way. I saw a sign in the store the other day that said, aim for the moon, because if you miss it, you'll still land on a star. Now, I was corrected by a friend. The moon is closer than the stars.
I almost corrected you myself.
And yeah. So I had to change it. And so I've now said, aim for the moon and maybe you'll land on a passing asteroid.
Or a cloud or something celestial.
But it's always going to be better than you started out. Because if you improve yourself in some way, you've grown.
See, I asked you before, what was your major driver? And you gave a very thoughtful response. But I think a lot of it had to do with your optimism. And you even say that yourself. I mean, you set high standards for yourself. It's true. But I always felt optimistic along the trajectory that you followed.
With a great deal of insecurity. I mean,
that drives you too.
Yeah,
it?
No, it does drive me too. Because the only way I know to get rid of fear and the fear of failing is to just stick my head down and work harder not to fail. But yes. I am an optimistic person. There's something in me that says from every situation you can learn something.
I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you for, what will mainly turn out to be perhaps a legal opinion that you're going to render. But you come to very different conclusions, let's say, than Justice Thomas about the whole nature of your life and the relationship to affirmative action. Almost antithesis, really.
Well, yes and no. Both of us recognize fully that affirmative action is a double-edged sword. He talks about it. I talk about it in my room. It stimulates people to look at you differently. It provokes them to do that. The difference, perhaps, in our view of it is my understanding and appreciation that, at least for me, at that time when I was being admitted to schools I never would have been chosen for previously, that it opened a door and it gave me a chance to prove myself. And I tell kids all the time, you can live in other people's negative impressions about your worth, or you can choose to say, okay, however the door got open, it gets open in a lot of different ways for a lot of different people, the legacy kids who have parents who are alumni, athletic kids who get in through a different door as well. Lots of people get in through a lot of different doors. The real bottom line is, what do you do once you're there? And if you do something good and prove yourself worthy, nobody can take that away from you.
Also, one other message that comes across loud and clear here in all that you've said, that you want to communicate to young people and have young people realize, there's a lot of importance in reading. Not only writing, but reading. You only had Reader's Digest in your home.
Had two things. We had the Daily News, which was the local newspaper, and my mother read it inside out. My father read El Diario La Prensa, which was the Spanish newspaper that's still alive today, actually. Mm-hmm. And he read that cover to cover. So I had readers in my family. My mom didn't know that much about books. And so what she read was the Reader's Digest. And as I tell the story in my book, I used to read the condensed version of some novels or books and go to my local library trying to find them. And I never could. Took me being an adult to realize that in a poor neighborhood, the local library wasn't likely to get recent issues for a long, long time. But I couldn't figure out why my local library didn't have these books the Reader's Digest was talking about.
You know, Reader's Digest had some good, not only excerpts in it, it had like Increase Your Word Power and Humor, the Best Medicine.
Oh, I loved all of those.
Yeah. I mean, they were around my house, too. Must have been a thrill to give the oath of office to Vice President Biden.
Enormously. It is very difficult to describe for people how moving a moment like that can be. I understand, because I read the news the next day, that President Obama, as he was leaving the stage, the platform, turned around to look at the audience before him. I did that walking in, because I had never attended an inauguration before. And it takes your breath away to see that many people there. Forget about who's president or not, but that many people involved in a moment of our nation's history, and to be a part of it, at least for me, it's humbling, because I feel so blessed to have had that opportunity. And it's also magical to be a part of that. And so it was a very, very special day for me.
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum from our archives. Our guest was Justice Sonia Sotomayor. She made history in 2009 when she became the first Hispanic U.S. Supreme Court justice. She was discussing with us her memoir, My Beloved World, about her childhood in the Bronx. And she eventually went on to Yale Law School and the top court in the nation. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum up ahead on this Independence Day.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.